We begin the 5 o'clock Tuesday hour by welcoming in writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, Kimball.
What's wrong with your Boston Bruins? They looked, sleepy the other day.
They look sleepy twice now, haven't they?
Yes.
Going through the motions, a lot of puck watching. The first one was that was the exhibition game. Hard to get pumped for an exhibition game, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Have you ever played, like, summer hockey, right? You're in the league, you're playing summer hockey. It's like, okay. Like, you maybe do well, you maybe don't do well. You don't take it all that seriously. But then it was for real. And they looked pretty much the same that they did in the exhibition. Wasn't the goalie either. I know Rask was out, right, with something going on with him. But with the exception of one goal that I saw, it really had nothing to do with the goalie. I wonder if they're going to split up that first line.
I know this. They looked, they looked oddly uninspired, which leads us smoothly sort of into our topic of conversation today, which is inspiration.
Oh.
How's that for a professional radio segue?
You sound to me, if I had to guess, like a man who's done this for 4 decades.
Came out of the womb doing this, and it was frightening for both parties.
Yeah, I would imagine.
So what is, better than anybody, what is the nature of inspiration for you, for anybody?
I feel like I'm a giver of inspiration, Kimball.
Yes.
Sometimes people conflate inspiration with trying to do what somebody else is doing. And that's not really what inspiration is. I was in college. You see him on the emails there, Norberg. Norberg was a guy I met when he was a 26-year-old professor, and he was actually the only professor I had in college who said, look, you're only going to fail here because you don't do this really boring kind of writing. You write for the world. So just ignore what people tell you while you're going through these years and find your own way. He said, read things that inspire you. And I thought, that's not really accurate, because what people tend to do when they seek out work that inspires them, like if it's within their line of work themselves, their profession, they're doing a kind of like mimicry. What you want to do is find something that's going to connect with you at the level of who you are and what you are going through at that point in your life, which is endemic to you, and do your version of that thing, and to make it wholly new, to make it unique to you. But you sort of got that idea, that spark, that kick in the ass from somewhere else.
Where do you find it? If you don't find it in other people's work and other people's art, is that something that's strictly internal?
No, I think you do find it. You find it externally. And then if it's really, truly inspirational, it becomes something you're able to internalize. So you don't get it on social media. You might get it out in a forest and you see the way a leaf falls out of a tree and it makes you think of something. You might get it from, no books written right now for the most part, but you might get it from, I don't know, reading Flaubert. You might get it, I had mentioned those two instances of where I found it. Those recent blog posts I was rewatching the other night, I hadn't seen it in a while, the Robert Bresson film, A Man Escapes. It's a 1956 film, and it's about a guy named Lieutenant Fontaine. And he is a member of the French Resistance, and he's caught by the Nazis in occupied France. And he goes to this jail, this like old sort of rundown, almost like out of the Old West jail. And he eventually finds out his fate. He's going to be executed, but he doesn't know when it's coming. They conduct these executions at this sort of makeshift prison. And he realizes that the door of his cell, again, in sort of this ad hoc prison, it's almost like this former hotel, is not really made to contain somebody. So he gets a spoon, he sharpens the spoon, and he just starts slicing away at the door. And it's going to take him like many months to disassemble his door, which doesn't even really prove to be the way that he ultimately is going to get out. And there's this scene. I mean, it made me weep. He's at his window, and he has this neighbor on the other side. You don't see his face. They're both at their window. And the neighbor pleads with him. He says, you're going to get the entire floor in trouble. There is no hope of escape. There's no way you could possibly get out. What are you doing? And Fontaine answers him by saying, I battle the door. And I just thought, F me. That is like... right? I mean, he's not talking about panels of wood. He's talking about something existential and human and transcendent. And yeah, you battle the door, man. Now, you don't actually have like a door that you're going at like with a spoon in your house tonight, but that's relatable. You know exactly what he means by that, or you think you do. And that's, I guess, the great thing about inspiration is because it doesn't even have to be like something you understand properly, but you can still tailor it to whatever you might be going through or enduring or trying to overcome, whatever it might be.
Well, and you have the outlet, you have the talent, you have the creativity to take that and make it change the way you think about life, art, yourself, the world around you. What do people do who don't have that? How do they take that inspiration and channel into non-artistic pursuits?
I think it's a life pursuit. I don't think it's an artistic pursuit. And really, when art functions as art, it's not an artistic pursuit anyway. It's a life pursuit. It's not about, okay, I saw this in a film, and that's going to inform how I do my sculptures or my painting or my collage art. Like there, it's a life thing. It's going to inform how you get the stones necessary to go to the hospital to visit the person that maybe you didn't have the greatest relationship with, and you've had a bad experience. Maybe you lost the spouse in the hospital, and you don't really want to go for a number of factors, and you find a way to go and to do the right thing. I think that's where that's the point of art. Art is nothing if it's not informing our lives. It's not art then. It's something else entirely. And when art informs our lives, it's actually influencing the choices we make and who we're going to be as people and what we're going to resolve to face. Maybe you think of Fontaine or whatever it is, I battled the door, and you think, I battled the bottle. I'm not having that tonight. Whatever it may be. And it will work on us because of our humanness. It doesn't require complexity. It doesn't anything like that. This is the nature of inspiration. Now, also the nature of inspiration is not a lot of people have it in them to inspire us, truly. What you're really talking about is a leader. I don't mean like some elected official, but there aren't just a lot of people in the history of civilization who are cut out to lead, to say, come with me, let's go. We're going to be able to do this, and you can do this, and it's actually going to pay out for you in terms of your humanness. Now follow me. Let's go.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. You also talked in the blog about the bag skate. For anybody who doesn't know what that is, can you give us a little summary of that?
Sure. Everyone who's ever played hockey, organized hockey, not just pond hockey, will know what the bag skate is. And people who haven't played organized hockey will have no clue what the bag skate is. And it's a very literal term in some ways. You go to practice, and what you look forward to at practice is when the pucks come out. There's literally a bag of pucks. Everybody calls it the puck bag. It's just like the universal term. Pucks hit the ice. Before practice starts, you're screwing around, firing it against the boards, passing with the teammate. But there are also practices where the pucks are going to remain in the bag, and you are going to do nothing but skate, the aforementioned bag skate. And there are variations on this, but the most common is what you do. They're called killers. So you're on the goal line at the far end of the rink, and you're going to sprint to the near blue line, back to the goal line, to the red line, goal line, far blue line, back to the goal line, then all the way down to the far goal line, and then back to the goal line. And you're going to do that like 30 times. Some coaches will have a bucket in the middle of the ice, which you vomit into, and it has to reach a certain level of thickness before. It's probably like wrong now, but it's a bad time, man. And the bag skate, it can be a verb like, oh dear, coach is going to bag skate us to that. I had a coach who, there was a clock on the wall at the rink, and you had to stop facing this clock every time. And if someone screwed this up, you didn't get the little rest that you would have of like 30 seconds between the bag skates. And he would just yell, mental discipline. And I remember I asked him one time, I was like, what is it with you and this clock? And he said, time and tide wait for no man. And I just thought, this is wonderful. This is brilliant. I would not endure what I endure. I'd be dead if I was not just bag skated so often in the past, because it taught me about mental discipline and it taught me about time. And the whole nature of the bag skate, the purpose of it isn't to inflict punishment upon somebody, although that's certainly an element of it. It's so that when you're playing your opponent and it's late in the game and you should be at that point where you're about to lose, you have what F. Scott Fitzgerald termed the extra that I have. And something kicks in. You're able to overpower your opponent. You have an extra bounce in your step. You're able to finish your check. You're able to instigate and dictate the play, and you prevail. Now, that's a hockey thing, but there's nobody within hearing of my voice right now who can't think, I need to bag skate myself in life. I'm going to bag skate this and do this thing. Like, that's exactly the way inspiration works. And it's just a hockey term. No one would think twice about it. I'm sure no one's put it in these terms, but now that everyone hears this, they'll think like, yeah, I'm not even a hockey fan, and that's relevant to me. I'm pumped up.
So how do you take that inspiration and personally channel it?
I think it's going to be dictated by a number of factors. It's going to be what's going on in your life. And everything is a conscious decision. I mean, just like even love is a conscious decision. I was talking about that with somebody. Like, you fall in love with somebody, but you also have to at some point decide to be vulnerable to another person, which is a decision component of love. It's a choice. And everything in life is of any consequence is a decision that you make. So you are now presented with this meaning. It's up to you after that to say, you know what, I'm going to apply this to this thing I'm struggling with. And maybe I'm not going to figure it out today, or maybe it's going to take me a while still yet, but I am going to start. I am going to start my version of doing this. You have to do that rather than, oh, you know what, I'm just going to drink and watch Netflix and get on Twitter and post about Trump. It's a decision to not do that. It's a decision to be less passive in your own life, because you've seen this example of someone presumably doing something or of something or has created something beyond your quotidian existence. You just have to do your smaller version. And it's like someone's extended their hand and said, yeah, you can do this. See me? I'm out here doing it. See this work? See how it makes you feel? Get pumped up. It's your life, man.
So how does inspiration then help you see yourself?
Me personally?
Yeah.
I've reached a strange point. I've reached a historically unique point where I'm not really inspired anymore. As I was telling my sister, at this point, I feel like I am story. I am art. It's not even something that I do. It's something that I am. That's why I can just sit down and say, okay, what do you want to make? And I start moving the fingers and something happens. But it was a lot of years before that of working towards something, of being on my own. It was getting up at writing all night and sleeping for an hour and getting up and going out. It was after that horrible divorce situation of literally, I don't expect other people to do this, but it was literally walking 3,000 miles a year. It wasn't with podcasts and earbuds. It was just me with my thoughts. And it changed me. I wrote two books that I know we've talked about, at least one of them, Dark March and Anglerfish Comedy Troupe. And I found with those two books, it was the start, I realized, of my own work changing me. And that's really, when I do what I do now, that's where what faith in my outcome comes from. It comes from my own work. I think, like, if you're this low, if you're barely hanging on, and your own work is making you think you need to keep going because this is going to impact the world in a way that things haven't previously, then that speaks to its power to inspire. But it's also just something I do, like breathing. So it's really become interrelated in that way. But I think even just when I took something like these terms, if I battled the door and the bag skate, there were two blog posts about those. I think if people looked at them, they would be inspired through that. So it's different. It's different for everybody. And I think as you evolve and you reach a different point, maybe it's not as overt when you're inspired, and that's probably why the whole I battle the door thing stood out so much to me. I mean, I literally cried. I battled the door. It's just like, you're born in the same day as Kafka, right?
Yes.
Kafka in his journals, this is another one that just was on my mind. He's writing in his journals, and he gives this life advice. He says, ride your enemy's horse. I mean, that means you've knocked your enemy on his ass. And you've taken his ride. Like, you're literally
going places after having overthrown this tyrant. I mean, it's just like a few words. I don't know how, like you could have given that to me as a locker room speech, and I would have gone out and decapitated somebody.
Now, I'm curious about this, Colin, because we've talked about the battle you face in dealing with a ridiculous publishing industry, but your work, those of us who get to see it, those who read it and appreciate it and love it and are inspired by it, but are you able to get any satisfaction from it?
No, and sometimes I feel like when I do worry that I'm cursed and doomed, and I actually do worry that. I wonder why God would give that much ability to one person and equip them with a comparable level of will and drive, strength, only to put stone after stone in their pathways. It's so, I fret when each week I can feel myself, it's like their powers. I feel them grow and I can do more things. And it's already so confused, and we've talked about this, what I do anyway. I mean, today there was a short story that ran with Jazz Times. And Jazz Times is this decorated magazine. It's been around for 50 years. It's the first fiction they've ever ran is by me. And I'm sure people at Jazz Times just know me as Jazz Guy.
And this the Louis Armstrong piece?
Yeah.
And it's brilliant. Man.
Yeah. And it's timely. But it'll throw those people who, and I think, and we've done like so many of these now, like 100, whatever it is. We've done a lot of these now. It's probably like 150. We probably only talked about jazz like 3, 4, 5 times. I'm sure I've referenced it a bunch of other times, and examples of other things. But there are people like who read Jazz Times, it will be like a shock to them that I write fiction. They think I'm just like Jazz Guy. Like, where's the Jazz Pulitzer? And there are all sorts of people in all these different facets. So I almost have this sinking sensation. Wait, you see the 3 stories I wrote this week? It's like, ah, oh, these are so good, and who's going to see this? And it's so... it's not even natural for me. I saw this ad on Facebook where you can learn through this miraculous course to write 2,000 words in a day. Like the unreachable. That's an hour here, and they're done. And they're like that little, I don't even know how long it is, but the whole thing probably took me like 2 hours to do. So I get crestfallen, but then I try to have the faith like, okay, just because it hasn't happened yet doesn't mean that it's not going to. Keep yourself in shape, keep your heart strong, keep going, because when it does, you'll have this corpus, this body of work that people are going to look at and be like, what the hell? How did this happen? And what sort of industry seeks to suppress someone who can do this? But it's that same friend, Norbert, he used to say it's like chopping wood, man. And that is a component of making art. You get up, you chop the wood. If you go out and just start shooting free throws 1,000 a day, you'll get better at it. So I chop the wood, and I just keep getting better at chopping the wood, I guess.
And, you know, I always judge people by, often by the way dogs relate to them. And the fact that dogs and small children see something wonderful about you tells me all I need to know.
It makes a certain, like, people, it seems, I mean, I've never been liked in my life by people. And I'm, if you met me out in the world, I sound like I do. You had said that once. If we went to Dunkin' Donuts, I think you'd probably sound exactly like you do when you come on the show. And that's true. And people tended not to like me for my mind, the rapidity with which I think, all of that stuff, like things that ought to be virtues. And I think the same things that are those good qualities are going to be what help a lot of people to like me later on when this turns. But throughout my entire life, animals and kids have always warmed to me. Like birds will hop right over to me. I have a, for all of the passion and everything, I have a prevailingly gentle nature. Although I'll say this, and if anyone in my building is listening, maybe it was just this family, I had fresh sunflowers out there on Friday, Kimball. They were fine yesterday. I go out there today, I think someone killed my sunflowers.
Uh-oh.
Because they look like they had been visited upon by a Lovecraftian blight, and the water was black. So, if anyone in the building is hearing this, I will cut you if you dick with my sunflowers again.
It wasn't the kid upstairs who's been prancing around.
You know what? I don't want to sell this kid down the river, but I heard them lingering in the hall yesterday, and I'm not so sure that something was not perhaps dumped in there. This was very unnatural. These flowers were melted, dude. They were fine yesterday. These were like swamp, like we're about to turn into peat flowers. And like this was a scary looking color. The shade, this water. I'm thinking like I don't even want to smell this. It's probably like acid in here. I was. I don't have a lot in my life right now. When I get those flowers, man, I expect them to last like 5-6 days for $4.99.
Right. Watch out for these people. Keep your head on a swivel. Keep those knees bent. Be ready for movement and action.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't like to really combine flowers with bodily threats. That's probably not done that often. But seriously, building people, I will mess you up if I catch you with my flowers.
There's a line. You've drawn it. They know what the stakes are. I hope they do the right thing. Hope your week improves, Colin. We'll see you again next Tuesday.
All right, sounds good.
Colin Fleming, check his work, colinfleminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog as well.